Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Yesterday I asked you guys this question about chapter 23, BYO discussion prompts. That was all I said. BYO discussion prompts. Courtieu said why the mazurka was such a big deal for Kitty and why Vronsky was expected to dance this specific dance only with her. The mazurka at 1870s Russian balls was not danced as a single dance. Instead, all couples would sit on chairs in a big circle, and only a few couples at a time would dance in the middle. When it's not your turn to dance, you can watch those who dance or talk with your partner. And this could go on for an hour or two. Of course, young people in love would use such an opportunity to talk with each other without the supervision of relatives. The figures of the mazurka that were danced by couples in turns were usually like mini games with a chance to exchange partners for the duration of the figure. Okay, so it was like a little round robin, loop-de-doop. There were hundreds of various figures, and the masters of ceremonies, or the conductor of the dances, could compose his own. Very interesting. Here's three examples. The chair. The gentleman conductor sets out and causes his partner to sit on a chair placed in the midst of the ballroom. He subsequently takes two gentlemen and presents them to her. He must select one of the two. He then makes the gentleman refuse to sit down. And proceeds to take two ladies whom he presents to him, that he might also choose one. The first gentleman retains the lady refused and conducts her in dancing to her place. It's very confusing. Flowers. The conductor selects two ladies and requests them to name to him, in a low voice, each a flower. He proceeds to present the two ladies to another gentleman and names to him the two flowers, from which he has to choose one. The second gentleman dances with the lady represented by the flower which he has named, and the gentleman conductor dances with the other lady. The lady of the first gentleman executes the same figure with the two gentlemen chosen by her. The cushion. The first gentleman sets out by holding in his left hand a cushion. He makes a tour of the room with his partner, with whom he leaves the cushion, which she must present to several gentlemen, inviting them to place a knee on it. The lady would withdraw, should withdraw it quickly from the gentleman she intends to deceive, and let it fall before the one she intends to select. And there were lots of different little games like that in the mazurka. A lot of fun and games. I suppose they didn't have electricity yet, so they had to do things like that. Nifty Riffic said, Lord, the headphone earbud wearers, beware. My portion of the podcast was deafening. Sorry, I'll try to match the volumes a bit better today, Nifty Riffic. This was a wonderful chapter, and it would do you well to actually read it with your eyeballs. I'm just positively in love with the descriptions of Anna's expressions being mirrored by Vronsky's face and how her smile passes onto him. What a way to say that these two people are sharing something together. Of course, all this is parallel to Kitty's horror. So you have something exquisite and horrible intermingled, and I love it very much. ScienceNerd311 said, first time commenter here. Welcome to the show, ScienceNerd. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the subreddit. I love this idea of reading a book together. Reading all of your unique thoughts and experiences is really refreshing. At first, the romantic in me felt everything Kitty was feeling. I was initially very angry with Anna. But the more we watch this play out, the more I feel like Anna is letting it happen on purpose, playing along. Kitty is naive and Anna already knows that what kind of man Vronsky is. She already knows plenty about him from the train ride with his mother. Her own brother has already cheated on her sister-in-law. I feel like Anna may be protecting Kitty by allowing her to see what Vronsky really is. I could be completely wrong, but I hope not. I would like to believe that Anna respects her own husband and child enough not to mess that up. She seems more like a fixer to me. I am Norwegian said I never expected to feel so much tension over a guy dancing with the wrong lady at a ball. I think I was very wrong yesterday to say that Anna was just being perceptive about Vronsky. There's something very different going on here. Instead of the kind and sincere woman from earlier chapters, here she felt like a force of nature dominating Vronsky like that. Still, I have to admit that I don't really know what is going on here. JMama8779 said, I called it. What's next, though, I wonder? Will they hook up? Or is this why Anna wants to leave the following day? Meanwhile, did Levin leave Moscow already? The drama is about to unfold. Soma Stars replied, saying, I think Anna knows that as a married woman, she needs to get the hell out of there. Swim said, the mama fishy said, I rather think that 18-year-old Kitty is feeling the humiliation after turning all those others away, of everyone knowing she has nobody to dance with. The mazurka with total humiliation was avoided by the kindness of the master of ceremonies dancing with her. She should be upset with Vronsky, who, after all, did not ask for the dance after doing so many times before. Of course, she had an expectation, but it was so much easier to project those bad feelings on satanic Anna, who is struggling with her own attraction to Vronsky. Minial said, I spent this chapter just imagining how they dance. I used to dance folk dance as a hobby, so I know those dances and could really imagine them dancing. Oh, that's nice. Henry Loz 70 said, I believe Anna is afraid of what she is feeling with Vronsky and is quite aware that she has already affected Kitty in a terrible way. So she has decided to go away and try to avoid more trouble. I believe it might be too late, though, once that Kitty has seen the way Vronsky follows Anna and ignores her. I doubt that she will be able to forget it, and it might be impossible for her to forgive Anna, because she sees that deep inside Anna is enjoying the effect that she is causing on Vronsky. Alright, very, very interesting. Big thanks to Nifty Rific for reading yesterday's chapter, and thanks for reading today's chapter. So we've got another guest reading here today from Nifty Rific. 2 days in a row, what a treat. Lovely voice. It's nice to have a different voice, probably, I'm sure, for you guys to hear the chapter, so I really appreciate that, Nifty. I also really appreciate those who have got themselves a copy of Bogan War and Peace. What do I want to say there? It's a ridiculous book. It's ridiculous, and it makes me laugh, and I hope it's making other people laugh. There's such a nerve-wracking thing that happens when you release a book, that it just takes so long to get feedback on a book. So far, that book's been out and literally no one said anything to me about it. And it's not because they haven't enjoyed it, or it might be, but it just takes a long time for feedback to get back to you about a book. Especially like if I buy a book today, it's going to go on the end of a list of about 20 books that I've got on my to-read list. So if I get your book today and I'm really excited to read it, it still might be years before I actually get around to reading it. So the handful of copies of Bogan War and Peace that are out there, I'm sure haven't even really been flicked through yet. But then even if they have, even if 10 people have gone ahead and had a little look through, not many people will come back to the author with feedback. Like, have you ever written to an author and said, hey, I just finished your book, it was great? Probably not. I don't know. It's a funny thing with books. It's a very nerve-wracking time waiting for that first bit of feedback. I think the reason I feel this so strongly is because I'm used to, like, growing up, I played in bands and we did a lot of album releases and EPs and stuff. And you do a show, big concert, to release the EP. And then people would come to that show and they would buy copies of the CD. And then on their way home from the show, they would listen to the CD. And by the time you even got home from the show, people were starting to text you to say, just had a listen, really, really cool, loved it, whatever. You're starting to get feedback literally within the hour of it being released. A book, it's like, if you get feedback in the first month of it being released, that's really good. It's probably going to be at least 2 or 3 months before anyone comes back around to you and tells you what they thought of it. Anyway, so why am I saying that? I don't know, I just got a bit sidetracked by my own thoughts. That happens sometimes. Enjoy this reading of chapter, what are we up to? Chapter 24. Yeah. By Nifty Rific. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.
Hiya, ya Hemingway list folks. This is Nifty Rific, and I'm reading for you chapter 24 of Anna Karenina. And don't fret, because Ander is back tomorrow. Thanks for letting me read to you. I hope it wasn't too awful to listen to. And I learned some things, like you basically can't just have the microphone in your mouth, and every time you breathe, it records it. So I had to edit out a lot of breathing. I breathe like Darth Vader. All right, chapter 24. Yes, there is certainly something objectionable and repellent about me, thought Levin after leaving the Shabatskys as he walked towards his brother's lodgings. I do not get on with other people. They say it is pride. No, I'm not even proud. If I had any pride, I should not have put myself in such a position. And he pictured to himself Vronsky, happy, kind, clever, calm, and certainly never placing himself in such a terrible position as he, Levin, had been in that evening. Yes, she was bound to choose him. It had to be so. And I have no cause to complain of anyone or anything. It was my own fault. What right had I to imagine that she would wish to unite her life with mine? Who and what am I? A man of no account, wanted by no one and of no use to anyone? And he remembered his brother Nicholas and kept his mind gladly on that memory. Is he not right that everything on earth is evil and horrid? And have we judged brother Nicholas fairly? Of course, from Prokofsky's point of view, who saw him in a ragged coat and tipsy, he is a despicable fellow, but I know him from another side. I know his soul and know that we resemble one another. And yet I, instead of looking him up, dined out and came here. Levin went up to a lamppost and read his brother's address, which he had in his pocketbook, and then hired a sledge. On the long way to his brother's, he recalled all the events he knew of Nicholas's life. He recalled how, despite the ridicule of his fellow students, his brother had lived like a monk while at the university, and for a year after, strictly observing all the religious rites, attending service, fasting, avoiding all pleasures, and especially women, and then how he suddenly broke loose, became intimate with the vilest people, and gave himself up to unbridled debauchery. He remembered how his brother had brought a boy from the country to educate, and in a fit of anger had so beaten the lad that proceedings were commenced against him for causing bodily harm. He remembered an affair with a sharper to whom his brother had lost money, and whom he had first given a promissory note and then prosecuted on the charge of fraud. That was when his brother Sergius had paid the money for him. Then he remembered the night when Nicholas had spent in the police cells for disorderly conduct and the disgraceful proceedings he had instigated against his brother Sergius Ivanich, whom he accused of not having paid out to him his share of his mother's fortune, and lastly, the time when his brother took an official appointment in one of the western provinces and was there arrested for assaulting an elder. It was all very disgusting, but to Levin it did not seem nearly as disgusting as it must have seemed to those who did not know Nicholas, nor his whole story, nor his heart. Levin remembered that when Nicholas was passing through his pious phase of fasting, visiting monks and going to church, when he was seeking in religion for help to curb his passionate nature, not only did no one encourage him, but everyone, and Levin among them, made fun of him. He was teased and called Noah and Monk, and then, when he broke loose, no one helped him, but all turned away from him with horror and disgust. Levin felt that his brother Nicholas, in his soul, in the innermost depths of his soul, despite the depravity of his life, was no worse than those who despised him. It was not his fault that he was born with his ungovernable temper and with a cramped mind. He always wished to do right. I will tell him everything. I will get him to tell me everything. I will show him that I love and therefore understand him. Levin decided in his mind, as towards 11 o'clock he drove up to the hotel of which he had the address. Upstairs, number 12 and 13, said the hall porter, in reply to Levin's question, is he in? I expect so. The door of November 12 was ajar, and from within, visible in the streak of light, issued dense fumes of inferior and weak tobacco. Levin heard a stranger's voice, but knew at once that his brother was there, for he heard him coughing. As he entered the doorway, the stranger's voice was saying, it all depends on how intelligently and rationally the affair is conducted. Konstantin Levin glanced into the room, which was beyond a partition, and saw that the speaker was a young man with an enormous head of hair, who wore a workman's coat, and that a young pockmarked woman in a woolen dress, without collar or cuffs, was sitting on the sofa. So apparently, this is an aside, without collars or cuffs, At that time, better class women always wore something white around their necks and wrists. He could not see his brother, and his heart sank painfully at the thought that Nicholas lived among such strange people. No one noticed him, and as he took off his galoshes, he overheard what the man in the workman's coat was saying. He was talking about some commercial enterprise. "Oh, let the privileged classes go to the devil," said his brother's voice with a cough. "Masha, get us some supper, and bring the wine if any is left, or send for some." The woman rose, came out from behind the partition, and saw Konstantin. "Here's a gentleman, Nicholas Dmitrich," she said. "Whom do you want?" said Nicholas Levin's voice angrily. "It is I," answered Konstantin Levin, coming forward into the lamplight. "Who's I?" said the voice of Nicholas Levin still more angrily. Konstantin heard how he rose hurriedly and caught against something, and then in the doorway before him he saw the familiar yet ever strange figure of his brother, wild, sickly, gigantic, lean, and round-shouldered, with large, frightened eyes. He was even more emaciated than 3 years before, when Konstantin Levin had last seen him. He was wearing a short coat, and his hands and broad bones appeared more immense than ever. His hair was thinner, but the same straight mustache covered his lips, and the same eyes, with their peculiar naive gaze, looked out at the newcomer. "Ah, Kostya," he said suddenly, recognizing his brother, and his eyes lit up with joy. But at the same moment, he turned to look at the young man and convulsively jerked his head and neck as if his necktie were strangling him, a movement Levin knew well, and quite another expression, a wild, suffering, and crude look, settled on his haggard face. "I wrote both to you and to Sergius Ivanich that I do not know you and do not wish to know you. What is it? What do you want?" He was not at all as Konstantin had imagined him. Konstantin, when thinking of him, had forgotten the most trying and worst part of his character, that which made intercourse with him so difficult. But now when he saw his face, and especially that convulsive movement of his head, he remembered it all. "I do not want anything of you, especially," he answered meekly. "I have simply come to see you." His brother's timidity obviously softened Nicholas, whose lips quivered. "Ah, you've come just for that," he said. "Well, come in, sit down. Will you have some supper? Masha, get supper for three. No, wait a little. Do you know who this is?" he added, turning to his brother and pointing to the man in the workman's coat. "It is Mr. Kritsky, my friend ever since my Kiev days, a very remarkable fellow. Of course, the police are after him because he's not a scoundrel." And he glanced around at everybody present, as was his way. Seeing that the woman in the doorway was about to go out, he shouted to her, "Wait, I told you." And in the awkward and blundering manner familiar to Konstantin, he again looked round at everybody and began to tell his brother about Kritsky, how he had been expelled from university because he had started a society to help poorer students, and also Sunday schools, and how he had afterwards taught in an elementary school, and had been turned out from that too, and had then been tried on some charge or another. "You were at Kiev University?" Konstantin Levin asked Kritsky in order to break the awkward silence that followed. "Yes, at Kiev," Kritsky replied with an angry frown. "And this woman," said Nicholas Levin, interrupting him and pointing to her, "is my life's companion, Mary Nikolaevna. I took I'm sure it's pronounced much nicer than the way I just said it. Mary Nikolaevna. I took her out of a house." And as he said this, he again jerked his neck. "But I love and respect her, and beg all those who wish to know me," he added, raising his voice and scowling, "to love and respect her. She is just the same to me as a wife, just the same. So now you know whom you have to deal with, and if you fear you will be degraded, there's the door." And again his eyes glanced questioningly around. "Why should I be degraded? I don't understand." "Well, Masha, order supper for three, with vodka and wine. No, wait, no, never mind. You may go." That's chapter 24.